The Pat Kenny Show.
With the Jaguar E-Pace. Beautiful by design and dynamic to drive. Delivering performance that is unmistakably Jaguar.
This is News Talk.
Argus Akoiza. Prince Philip and I are delighted to be here and to experience at first hand Ireland's world famous hospitality. Together, we have much to celebrate. The ties between our people, the shared values, and the economic, business, and cultural links that make us so much more than just neighbours, that make us firm friends and equal partners. Madam President, speaking here in Dublin Castle, it is impossible to ignore the weight of history, as it was yesterday when you and I laid wreaths at the Garden of Remembrance. Indeed, so much of this visit reminds us of the complexity of our history.
And that's Queen Elizabeth II. Next week, we'll see the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge making a royal visit to Ireland, taking in Dublin, Meath, Kildare and Galway. And Kensington Palace says the trip will be to highlight the many strong links between the UK and Ireland. In the nearly 10 years since Queen Elizabeth's royal visit to Ireland in 2011, there have been numerous visits by other members of the British royal family. But what of previous British royal visits when Ireland was not a neighbouring state but a part of the United Kingdom? I'm joined by UCD lecturer in modern Irish history, Dr. Conan Mulva, to talk about previous royal visits, beginning, I suppose, with the first visit of Queen Victoria.
Yes, Pat, good morning.
Conor, good morning to you. When was that?
So the first visit of Queen Victoria, I suppose, brings us on the starting point of an arc that goes from maybe acrimonious to the very convivial speech we had in 2011 that we just listened to. This was in 1849, and it's quite interesting how this came about. So this was, as the British administration saw it, to mark the end of the famine. Now, the issue was that the famine wasn't really over and there were lingering pockets of famine right into 1851 and 1852. There hadn't been a royal visit for 28 years since King George IV arrived drunk in 1821, apparently having partaken of pies and Irish whiskey on the boat on the way over. So, there wasn't a great precedent for this. But anyway, Queen Victoria arrived with Albert and four of her children in Cork in August of 1849. And then she travelled on to Dublin and Belfast. And it was quite an interesting trip because this was really a propaganda exercise to say Ireland is back in business, the famine is over. As aforementioned, that might not have been the case. But for instance, she went to Carlton House, now famous for hosting the Irish rugby team and things like that. And there she went to watch a dance of the peasantry on the lawn of Carlton House. Margarita Capock, who's one of the historians of propaganda and these royal visits, she noted that there were sturdy looking peasant couples dancing before them, demonstrating happily idealised versions of Ireland that were often rather lacking in evidence in the famine, poverty and disease elsewhere in the country. So a very staged royal visit with a very clear purpose behind it in order to kind of
Was there any fear of what we nowadays would call terrorism?
Yes. So again, to quote Capock, she says that Queen Victoria was particularly afraid of later rumours of Fenian assassination plots, the rumours of Irish secret societies and the general air of unrest and revolt in Ireland. And it did little to cultivate any sense of fondness for the Irish with the Queen, who possessed a strong fear of rebellion in any guise. So Queen Victoria, she ended up going to Ireland on four occasions, again 1853.
Which is very shortly after the first one.
Yes, 4 years afterwards. And then in 1861. So that really marked the high point of her visits to Ireland. But then she didn't visit again until 1900, the year before she actually died.
In 1861, she went to see the Lakes of Killarney.
Yeah, so this is the kind of famous visit. And this is the one that I suppose both tourists to Ireland and people who go touring within Ireland would have the best sense of. So if you go down to Mucker's house in Kerry today, which is a brilliant tour to go on, a really fascinating house, that at the time was the home of Henry Albert Herbert, and he nearly bankrupted himself in the kind of 5 years before her visit, getting the place ready for Queen Victoria's visit. So he installed a royal bedchamber and all these other...
Yeah, and they built a road up to the viewing spot.
They did, yes. Yeah. So Ladies View, which not named after Lady Queen Victoria, but after her ladies-in-waiting, who were so taken by the view at that particular point that it became a noted tourism spot thereafter. And here we can kind of see the linkage of the royalty with tourism into Ireland and with kind of promoting Irish industries as well. That was another hallmark of her 1853 visit, which was to see the industrial fair in Dublin.
Why did the Queen go to the Curragh?
So Bertie, as he was then, soon to be, well, not soon to be actually, it took him a very long time to become Edward VII because his mother lived so long. He was training in the Curragh to be an officer. And during her 1861 visit, after spending 2 days in Muckra's house, she travelled up to the Curragh to watch military manoeuvres by her 20-year-old son in the Curragh. But that might not be his only...
He had other things on his mind. A young actress called, what, Nellie Clifton.
So Nellie Clifton appears to have been one of the early infatuations of the then Albert, the future king of the British Empire. And Queen Victoria was horrified by the fact that essentially it seems that his fellow officers had taken him out, gotten him drunk, and I don't know at this time in the morning, but deflowered the young monarch, or the young monarch to be. So he later that year, King Albert, or Prince Albert, sorry, the future king's father, died of typhoid, but Queen Victoria apparently blamed the horror and anger at discovering this relationship on her husband's death. So she was A, angry at her son, but B, angry at Ireland, and it seems at the Curragh.
Okay.
For all this. So certainly
he died of typhoid.
Prince Albert died of typhoid. Yeah.
But it couldn't be directly related to
but it seems in the superstitious queen who wasn't so keen on Fenian rebellions and all kinds of things, she seemed to equate this to, I suppose, the weakness that he suffered after the anguish over his sons.
Okay, several decades later, she made her final visit in 1900.
Yes, so we were just talking about this off air before, that this is the visit that brings us some of the lyrics of Monto, the queen she came to call on us, she came to call on all of us. I'm glad she didn't fall on us, she's 18 stone. And it carries on from there. But between the 3rd and the 27th of April, so for nearly 3 weeks, or for over 3 weeks in 1900, Queen Victoria came to Ireland. And this visit for the much older monarch was centred around Dublin. There's an interesting kind of street pageantry and theatre to all of these visits going right back to 1849, which is that kind of triumphal arches were put up in the cities in which the Queen visited. In 1849, she had demanded that in Cork these would be very austere so that it wouldn't, I suppose, reflect lavishness at the very end of the famine, or not really the very end of the famine. But by 1900, these were quite elaborate temporary structures. So there are photographs and even video of some of these on British Pathé's newsreel site, looking at the Queen going through an arch on Leeson Street and other sites around Dublin. So this was an interesting part of the pageantry. You had a lot of hangers-on and members of the Irish court who would have circled around the Lord Lieutenant following the Queen around. Yeah. So you can see vast troops of horse.
Any protests?
Yes. So maybe let's focus in on Maud Gonne, who has an interesting protest at this time. So one thing was that the Queen organised a Children's Day at the Phoenix Park, and Arthur Griffith and Maud Gonne decided this would be a great opportunity for them to protest rising Irish nationalism 2 years after the centenary of 1798, and also the Boer War, which was very unpopular in Ireland and very popular among the royal family. So they organised a loyal and patriotic children's treat for all the kids who had missed Queen Victoria's party the week before. And in some ways this was a very strong origin point for all of the advanced nationalism that followed. So the networks that were created out of the Loyal and Patriotic Children's Treat created Fianna Éireann, created a lot of the circles that I suppose led into the Irish Volunteers and other advanced nationalists.
Yeah. Moving on to her death and then the crowning of Albert, who is now somewhat more mature as Edward VII. When did he come to Ireland?
So only 3 years later in 1903, Edward VII comes to Ireland as monarch for the first time. And as I mentioned, he was quite familiar with the country before that. This was an opportunity to really embrace new technologies and tour the interior of Ireland. So this was the tour of the motor car. And the person who was picked to kind of lead this charge was Henry Augustus Robinson, who was a senior Irish civil servant at the time. He later was responsible for advising on the drawing of the Irish border, which is where I came across him. And there's a brilliant biography by Brendan O'Donoghue of him. And basically, he organised this motor trip to show off the congested districts, which had been one of the Conservative Party's big policy programmes in Ireland in the years prior to this. So they had been investing in what now we see as quite depopulated areas of Ireland by the time where they said over-congested with people and underproductive. So the party disembarked at Killary Bay, and from there motors drove them past Lake Fee and Muck onto Tully, a route that brought them through the most thickly populated and poorest districts, after which they went to Letterfrack in Kylemore Castle and from Kylemore to Rhesus for lunch. There the motors were taken to Galway and then by steam to Kenmare to drive on to Lord Lansdowne's estate for lunch, and then they proceed to Castletown to embark on a battleship for Queenstown.
Now, was King Edward VII still a bit of a lad, do we know?
No, I think he behaved himself by the time he was monarch. So, but he did, as I mentioned earlier, he had a long time to wait. So there is, I suppose, a parallel there between Charles and Edward, that because both of their mothers lived on so long, they really only took over monarchy very, very late in life.
Now, what about Maud Gonne? Was she active against the king as well?
Yes, so Maud Gonne had an interesting twist in 1903. So just before King Edward landed, the death was announced in Ireland of the Pope, Pope Leo the 13th. And as a result of this, the Dublin newspapers on the eve of the king's visit had black borders around the outside for the majority Catholic population of Ireland. Maud Gonne was fairly incensed by all the Union Jacks all around the city. And she had gone around the day before posting up anti-monarchical bills and anti-Union Jacks bills with Éinne na hÉireann, the Daughters of Éireann, who were her advanced feminist nationalist group. But she had gone home to her house on Coulson Avenue and became incensed by the last Union Jacks she saw that day before she turned in. She said even in this small part of the townships of kind of wealthy Dublin, there was some minor British civil servant who wanted to impress the monarchy by showing his loyalty. So he had the house across from Maud Gonne's decked out with Union Jacks. So Maud Gonne decided she was very put out by this, and she decided to put out a black flag outside her house on a broomstick. And the next morning she was woken by her housekeeper, who said, "The police have come and they've taken your broomstick and they've taken your black flag." So she said, "This won't do." So she took her lingerie, which were black. How I know about the colour of Maud Gonne's lingerie is that she wrote this in her Bureau of Military History witness statement, and she put them on a second pole and hung them outside the house. So then the DMP arrived and said, "Ma'am, we're going to have to take down that black flag slash knickers outside your house because it's the king's visit and we can't have anyone hanging out black." She had a revolver sitting on her table as she lunched in the garden and defied the DMP and anyone who came in to take the flag that she had a licence for her gun, which may have been out of date, and she'd plugged them if they went anywhere near her flag. And eventually she convinced the DMP that the reason her underwear were hanging on a pole outside her house was to mourn the death of the Pope, and the DMP, being good Catholics, decided they would leave her to her her flag.
Now, any objective accounts of the reception that the king got?
When King Edward VII's visit came along, we have a very interesting perspective here from George Wyndham, who was the Irish Chief Secretary. So this, obviously, a much more unionist observer. He had been one of the key architects of this constructive unionism. And his account of this, I think, is quite interesting. So for 3 miles around Trinity, one roar of cheers and frenzy of handkerchiefs. Every woman with a baby was there to jump up and down for the king. Every ragged urchin, every sleek shopkeeper, every rough and every battered old Irish woman with jewel eyes and wrinkled Russian leather face. They did not say "God save the king," however, as we do. They lifted their hands to heaven to imprecate "God bless the king," as if adjuring the deity to fulfil the most ardent desire and his most obvious duty. And Queen Alexandra pointed to this and that tatterdemalion, a word that I hadn't come across before, saying, "The poorer they are, the louder they cheer." And through the poorest parts of the North Circular Road was ever the same emotion. It brought tears to the Queen's eyes and a lump in my own throat. So a really interesting sense of, I suppose, the poverty of Dublin at a time when it did have the highest mortality or the infant mortality rate in Europe next to Russia.
Now, there was one more pre-independence visit, and we have to wait until the state visit of Queen Elizabeth II in 2011 to get another one. So what year was that? It was 1911.
1911, yeah. So King George V comes for a visit in 1911. And this is quite an understated affair, because by 1911, first of all, Home Rule was on the up. There wasn't a very strong reason to do this particular one. And his eyes were very much focused on India. So he was the first monarch to ever attend the Delhi Durbar, which was the celebration in Delhi to actually make him Emperor of India. So he came here from the 7th to the 12th of July. Interesting that he was here on the 12th, and he didn't leave Dublin. It was a much more small affair. So one of the ways we can track this is by looking at the amount of medals that were handed out to the police who carried out service on the day. And only about 2,500 medals were handed out for his visit, much less than the previous royal visits. So, yeah.
Now, therefore, we didn't get another monarch then for 100 years, but we did have Prince Charles in 1995. And there's some interesting accounts of that.
I came across this gem in the Irish Independent when I was looking at coverage of the 2011 visit. And they gave a nice synopsis of previous royal visits and of Prince Charles. Visit in 1995, so just after the IRA ceasefire in August of 94, this was a key time of peace and reconciliation. And I think somewhat unfairly, but also charmingly, they said of Prince Charles that he dodged eggs, saw the Book of Kells, and was told by one enthusiastic onlooker that he needed a hug. So a very interesting and short description of Charles's 1995 visit, but I think it's quite significant. Charles seems to have developed quite an interest in Ireland and quite a grow for it throughout his princeship since 1995. So just interesting, that was his first visit.
And there were stories going around that the Queen actually came to Ireland quietly. And how that would be managed, I don't know. But on horsey business.
Yes, I can't comment on this one. And it's certainly absent from the historical sources that I've consulted for this particular piece. Pure gossip at this point, but you know, with that 30-year rule, we might find something creeping out in the Department of Foreign Affairs papers in a couple of years' time.
This comment, it took us 800 years to get rid of them. Why do we keep inviting them back?
So well, I suppose to look at Queen Elizabeth's visit in 2011, and it was a really significant state event. And I think in terms of looking at the history of these islands, very significant. It's only a year after the decommissioning process was formally wound down by the International Commission on Decommissioning. So it just shows you how close in proximity aspects of the Troubles were. We can remember the Mazarine Barracks attack of 2009, which is quite significant, just before that visit. So what we refer to in history as cultural demobilisation, a term that the historian John Horne describes as how societies are taught to not hate each other in the aftermath of conflict. I think we can look at the 2011 visit as normalising state relations between our respective heads of state. So up to that point, royal visits by reigning monarchs, as opposed to the Charles visit in 1995, had been visits by a monarch to a part of their kingdom that they essentially were ruling with a large degree of opposition, particularly by the 1880s. However, this normalises to the same extent if we think of the JFK visit. This was the head of state of another country coming to visit Ireland on equal terms. And that parity of esteem that was created in the Good Friday Agreement really makes the Queen Elizabeth visit in 2011 quite, I think, a really stark and moving part of the overall high politics in the peace process.
Dr. Conor Mulva, lecturer in history at University College Dublin, thank you very much.